The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab number 225 for Monday, November 2nd, 2009. Greetings, folks. This is John.
Dave. Hi, John. How are
and
you?
And welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab number 225. We just thought we'd, you know, keep you on your toes here. So I am John F. Braun here. I'm in Fairfield, Connecticut. And on the other end, we have not one, but two distinguished guests. We have Dave Hamilton in Durham, New Hampshire, and probably
Pilot Pete.
Greetings, folks, and welcome.
There it is.
Hey, guys.
It's good to be back.
Yeah, man. It's been a long time since we've had the three of us here. Yeah.
You've been in a big metal tube for a while.
Too many times.
Yeah, so we've got some stuff that we didn't get to last week, John. And then we've got some stuff that we won't get to this week, because that's just how we roll. And that's just how it's going to go. We're just, you know, we get as you folks probably realize, we get lots and lots of info for the show, email, voicemail, voice memos. Yeah. Skype stuff, Twitter messages coming in, and try to aggregate it all and just sort of roll it into a rolling conversation is really what it kind of becomes. So today, John, I wanted to start off with our tips, which we kind of skipped from last week. And Jim wrote in, we had been talking about finding, I guess it was when you and I were out in Las Vegas for Blog World Expo, John, we were answering a question about how to find any file.
With Spotlight. Or not.
That's right.
And that's where this hinges on.
Yeah. And we've talked about a couple of other solutions here and also ways to customize Spotlight, which we talked about, I think, last week. And Jim wrote, I did a search for third-party solutions and found these two, which work. I tried both of the following on my fairly new MacBook Pro under 10.5.8, and they both successfully searched the entire hard drive. In the case of Find Any File, which we will put a link to, when the search was done with root permissions, it successfully found files in other users' directories. So there's Find Any File, which is a free solution, and then a commercial solution called Foxtrot, which Jim says seems a little more complicated and does not offer any better results than the free solution. So Foxtrot is at foxtrot.ch and Find Any File is at apps.temple.org. But we'll put links in the show notes. And of course, Michael Johnston of iPhone Alley will put the links right here in the enhanced AAC feed. So we're good to go. So thanks, Jim. That Find Any File, I played with that a little bit, John, last week, and it seems to work great.
It leads me to a tiny tangent, and then we will get back on track. But in general, I think we've spoken about this in the past a bit, but how you organize your information is, I think, important. Apple and Microsoft and others have suggested a layout which has, you know, most things in a root folder, and then, you know, going down to pictures, documents, movies, things like that. And some people follow that, some don't. The people that don't, you can tell because a lot of times I see this at work when somebody hooks their machine up to a projector, their entire desktop is full of icons. That is poor desktop management, in my opinion. So just to toss a little, in this case, though, it was looking for a preference file, which is not subject to this, but just in general, I think, you know, have a, you know, somewhat coherent strategy about what goes where. And I think their guidelines are usually pretty good. I organize my stuff along with Apple guidelines. And yes, my desktop is a bit of a mess, but it's usually stuff that's near term and I just want in front of me rather than archiving.
Yeah, so. I put a folder on my desktop that I call Kill Me. And that's the folder that if I need to create some temporary file or do some, you know, put some archive in there and unzip it, something that I'm going to do, you know, I'm not going to walk away from it until I'm done with whatever that data is important for, I do it there. And then that way it does sort of linger, but I also know that I am free and clear at any moment in time to completely wipe the contents of that folder out without having to think about it. Yeah. So
tangent back on track, but I thought I'd mention it because I've seen as of late a lot of, you know, I'm working with, you know, new employees, new interns, stuff like that. And I see some of them, and even, you know, people that have been around for a while, not necessarily computer people, you know, kind of, you know, fall into this trap of where's my stuff? And it's a big problem. Yep. So anyways, moving on.
All right. Jason has a tip to share with us. Hey, look. It's our friendly stutter audio time, isn't it? But we've paused and got through it. And now let's try Jason's comment again.
Hello, John and Dave. This is Jason. He just had a quick comment about the Mac Mini with the USB ports not working. I have seen this before on other Macs, and different user would result in the same thing. Booting from an external hard drive that has a good known operating system on, or maybe just a basic install of Leopard or Snow Leopard, and if it doesn't work then you pretty much can say it's hardware. But I have seen it where it hasn't worked with the internal hard drive and the OS that's on it, and then it does work when you boot from an external. So something else that the user can try to see if it actually is hardware or not. Thank you very much. Bye.
So thank you, Jason. Yeah, that was in regards to the comment from 2 weeks ago about not having about a potentially bad USB port and booting, or at least attempting to boot from a hard drive that is has a full OS on it from a USB port seems to be the magic, the magic litmus test, if you will, to make sure that it's going to work.
Now, the only thing that occurs to me is, and it was just something in the back of my mind because I've had this happen before, is if you create what we would call a generic drive, I believe there is still, and maybe this is not the case, but where if you create an external boot drive, all the drivers required, assuming, let's say you do a full copy of the drive, say from a portable onto an external drive, and then you plug it into a desktop. I don't believe there is an issue any longer. I think I had this problem in the past where if you try, and for the most part, it works fine. I think maybe there's some minor mismatches with, like, you know, display or print drivers and stuff. But I think in general, you can do that. But I guess my caution is just, you know, whatever system you use to derive the reference image.
Actually, John, I think there's zero difference now.
Good. Okay.
Between, you know, for example, a Snow Leopard install is a Snow Leopard install regardless. The only issue is when a machine comes out after the build that you have, you know, created, right? So if it's, let's say, you know, you had a machine with 10.5.8, right? And and you'd built a boot drive. Well, any machine that could run 10.5.8 will boot and be happy from that 10.5.8 install. However, the new 27-inch iMac was not built when 10.5.8 was around, and, you know, it ships with 10.6.1, so chances are it's not going to boot with that. Now, iMacs, you know, if it's the same guts, maybe it will, right? But there's no guarantees, and especially we've seen with laptops, new, you know, a laptop released after an OS build typically will not, you know, there is a minimum build required for any OS. Yeah.
Okay. I was curious, and you fulfilled my needs here.
That's what we're here for, man. That's what we do. All right. So Paul has in the cool stuff found category, Paul has an iTunes related tip.
Hey, John and Dave, it's Paul calling from Los Angeles. I came up with a cool trick that I thought I'd share with you and the rest of the listeners. You guys have helped us all out so many times. I figure I found something cool. I should pay you back and put something out there.
All right.
This has to do with, I actually almost called you guys to try and solve a problem. Came really close to calling you and then kind of stumbled upon the answer when Apple released iTunes 9. Let me go back and tell you the problem. I was trying to take some MP3s, some homebrewed MP3s, spoken word, various things, and I wanted to listen to them like I listen to a podcast, and that is on my iPhone or on my iPod, to be able to have the nice new fancy new skip back 30-second button, to have the variable speed playback. But I couldn't for the life of me try and figure out how to get an MP3 to act like a podcast within iTunes. The only way I could figure it out is to actually have iTunes subscribed to a podcast feed and it blessed it in some way that gave it those properties. Couldn't figure out a way to do it for the life of me, and then out comes iTunes 9, and I was just poking around inside, and I discovered that there's a new feature. If you take any music that you have in the music section, any MP3 that you have in the music section, I guess it would work on with an AAC as well, Get Info, go over to the Options tab of that Get Info window that opens up, and you'll see a heading that says Media Kind. And if you click on that tab to choose the different media kinds, you now have podcast. Now, there was always podcast there in previous versions of iTunes, if I remember correctly, but it was always grayed out. It was either automatically a podcast if you downloaded it or subscribed to it and got it as a podcast, but you could never just flip that switch. Now you can take a piece of audio, flip it to podcast. Along with that, you can then click the button a little bit lower down that says remember playback position. You hit OK, and it actually gets removed from your music section of iTunes and goes straight into the podcasting section of iTunes. You sync up and you can now do all those fancy tricks with that audio. You can have it play at variable speeds. You can have it skip back 30 seconds. So that's about it. Just wanted to let you guys know about that cool trick I found, and thank you in the meantime for doing such a great show. Keep up the great work.
Well, thank you, Paul. That's a killer tip. And folks, remember that, because I think if we have time, we're actually going to come back around to something that that references what we've learned from Paul. So thank you. Thank you very much, Paul. Our first sponsor for this show is a company that's been with us for a very long time, Smile on My Mac. Today we're talking about Disk Label. And what Disk Label does is it allows you to print inserts for the jewel cases, or even if you build a sleeve for your CD, you can print a little insert for your CD or DVD. Let's say you're making holiday music CDs, right? Well, you could build your compilation in iTunes, and then you can build a label that's way better than anything you're ever going to see from iTunes. And you can put your own custom artwork in there. You can print the songs. You can have it do all kinds of things with the text, and then output it to your printer. If you've got a, like I said, if you've got a jewel case, you can fold it up and put it in there. If you've got one of the taller DVD cases, they've got sizes and templates for that too. You can make, let's say you want to make a mix CD, right? Cause that's a cool thing to do. And you can put that in maybe as a stocking stuffer. If you're, you know, we've got the holiday season coming up, of course. If you want to create, say, a movie, you know, you build your, you've got all your family photos and videos from the year, and you go into iDVD and you stitch together this really cool, you know, collage of various things. Well, now you want to have a way of printing a label for the case, so that when somebody opens this thing up, they've got, you know, a case that's of the same quality as the movie and collages that you built inside. So Disk Label from Smile on My Mac at smileonmymac.com. There is a free trial of the app. And then once you're ready to buy, it's $35.95. And that's for Disk Label version 6, and all available at smileonmymac.com. So go check them out, and Disclave, it's cool. You definitely want to, you know, if you're doing anything like this, you definitely want to take a look. It's a fun app. So we're still in our tips section here, Pete, and you had a tip that you shared with me a couple weeks ago, and I had intended actually on doing it in last week's show, even though you weren't here and we didn't get to it. So now that you're here, it's like fortuitous timing.
It is.
Yeah.
I stumbled across this quite by accident. But I got the new iPhone 3GS and sold my old one on eBay for a great price, by the way. So it wound up costing me like $20 to upgrade.
Wow.
That was beautiful. But anyway, so I had a nice new case for it, and that case lasted about a month, and I dropped it and cracked it. And I'm like, oh, got to do something else. But the thing that was bothering me about the GS was the battery life. So I went out and I got one of those Mophie juice packs.
Oh, yeah.
Basically a secondary battery for your iPhone. Keeps it going an extra... Yeah, an extra day, as it were. You know, it's basically twice the battery life.
Right.
And right in the booklet, it says, hey,
now the juice pack is the battery that fits almost like a case around the iPhone.
Yeah, it's just like a case. Yeah. It's a little thicker than other cases, but not much. I mean, it's hard to notice. It makes the phone a little heavier, But again, you know, we're talking the iPhone. It's so light.
I've got one. I use the juice pack when I travel. Sure. It fits in the hand. Okay.
They're nice. Fine. And it's nice when you're traveling because if you're away from a power source for a while, you can do that. You know, leave the 3G running, leave the GPS functions running. Right. And it's great.
Right.
Okay. Let's see you guys with that. Yeah. How many, I'm curious because I have a product I'd like to mention in a moment, but how many would it be milliamp hours?
I'll look that up while Pete talks about his tip.
Okay, so anyway, I buy it and I take it home and I'm all excited about it because right in the book it says when you connect the cord, it's got a mini USB port on the bottom of it, and it fits into there, and the juice pack fits into the base of the phone, which is the standard cord fitting that comes with your iPhone. Anyway, I'm making that the long way around, but the point is it's going to sync up to your computer when you plug in the mini USB to the bottom of the juice pack and then plug that into your computer. One problem, it didn't. And I'm like, well, this is crazy. So I rebooted the computer, I rebooted the phone, did everything I could think of to make this thing sync up. And no matter what I did, my MacBook Pro would not recognize the iPhone. So I went, well, this is nuts. So I turned around, drove back to Best Buy the next day and said, I want to return it. It doesn't do what it says it does right here on page 3 of the manual. But I want another one. I really want this product. So I want to go get another one and test it. They're like, yeah, great. Go back there and get it. And I brought my MacBook Pro with me because I wanted the guy that was in the phone section working with me to see if he had any problems. And so I went up and I had to buy the new one again because they won't open one and test it. You have to buy it and then return it if it doesn't work. I'm like, okay. Well, it turns out the new one I had was an open box product. So it was $15 less. I'm like, oh, okay, this is great. So I go back there and I'm sitting there working with a guy. He goes, oh, no, it works. It syncs right up. And then it didn't. He goes, oh, hold on. So he pulls out his iPhone 3GS. And it wouldn't sync up. He goes, oh, I got one in the case. Let's try that. And it wouldn't sync up. And I'm like, you know what? Normally I wouldn't take this, but for $15 less, I want the extra battery power and I'll just slide the phone in and out of the case and sync it up when I need to. And I took it home. And being a pro traveler, I'm always looking for ways to lighten my load. And one of the ways I decided would lighten my load would be to reduce the number of cables.
Here comes the tip, folks.
Here it is. I pulled out my Kindle USB cable and looked at it and said, oh, that is the same fitting that's on the bottom of that Mophie juice pack. Just stuck it in there, stuck it in the computer, and it came right up, synced right up.
Yep.
And it was great. I was like, okay, so it's the crud cable that comes with the Mophie juice pack. All it will do is charge the phone. If you put a decent USB cable with a mini connector on it, it will sync right up with your computer.
So here's the thing, though, because sometimes you want that, right? Sometimes you want a cable that's not going to make the phone think that it's connected to a data source.
Sure.
Right. You know, you don't want it to be in that mode. So that, I mean, they shouldn't tell you that it's going to work and then ship it with a cable that clearly doesn't have data capabilities. But I have one of those Mophie juice packs and I realized that about the cable, but I use it strategically to be able to plug in. Like if I'm at somebody else's computer and I want to, you know, charge up or whatever, I don't have to worry about, is their iTunes going to whatever. It's like, oh yeah, this is my, you know, totally dead cable. It's my dumb cable. It's just juice and nothing else. So yeah, it's interesting. So I did look those up. The Mophie juice pack, the standard one, 1800 milliamp hours. They've got a new one that I just happened to notice on their website called the Juice Pack Air, which they say is thinner and it's 1200 milliamp hours. So with my regular juice pack, I've not seen the Air. I have been able to essentially fully recharge my iPhone from the dead and bring it up to 100% and still have a little bit of juice left on the juice pack itself. So
nice. So all right. The one that I like.
Yep.
And then we'll move on. Is the Richard Solo 1800.
Yeah.
Which I got at a recent trade show, which is, as the name implies, 1800 milliamp hours of battery power. So that plugs right into the connector on the iPod Touch and the iPhone, whatever uses that connector. And I bring that as a backup. And
well, that's
it
nice.
It helps when your iPod Touch. Well, the nice thing is, you know, the iPod Touch and the iPhone, except for, you know, a few features, are pretty much the same. So that's awesome because, yeah, you plug it in and it just says, oh, I'm charging off of something. And you can actually also plug in, which I think with a lot of these devices, you can plug an adapter into the device to charge it while it's charging whatever is plugged into it. So,
all these devices, to kind of flesh out the iPhone battery conversation, if you plugged power into the device while the device is plugged into your iPhone or iPod Touch, it will charge the iPhone or iPod Touch first. And then once that hits 100%, then it charges the battery pack. Just so you know, that's how that works.
Yeah. So shame on Apple for an replaceable battery, but the market deals with it.
Yeah. But if the one thing I don't like about that Richard Solo thing, I had one from Kensington that was the same thing.
But it has a laser, dude, and a flashlight.
I know.
I mean, dude, the laser.
Yeah. To drain that battery.
And Rich, and you guys know that Richard Solo is the guy who originally created Sharper Image, right? So, or that Richard Solo is the company of the guy, Richard, whatever his name is. But yeah, you know, it hangs way off the end and I can't put it in my pocket. With that big long thing, you know, sticking off of it. And I'm always afraid I'm going to snap the connector when it's like that. So that, but the nice part about it, is it will fit on the phone with some cases on. So there's, you know, you can go one way or another.
All right. We're not iPhone, man.
Let's get back to the Mac. So, last week we were talking about mail and we had a listener call in who was having issues where their mail sounds were not working. And we talked through a couple of solutions and then had you folks contact us with a couple more. The first one we got was via Twitter, actually, from Evan. And Evan suggested go into System Preferences, go into Sound, and then go to the Sound Effects tab, because there is a separate volume slider for sound effects, independent of the volume slider for the overall volume. If you set the overall volume to zero, you will not hear sound effects. But if your sound effects volume is set to zero and you bring the overall volume up, you still won't hear sound effects. So it's not entirely independent, but it is its own setting. Oh. So you can have your volume cranked, say for iTunes, but have your sound effects, you know, way down low so that, you know, every time you send mail, if you've got that whoosh, you know, sound, you don't hear that, you know, blazing through your speakers. So his advice was go in there and make sure your sound effects volume's not sitting at zero. That would be the easy answer. And then Ken has another option for us. But first, he wants to scold me.
Hey, John and Dave, this is Ken from Anchorage, Alaska. Hey, I was calling in regarding to episode 224 about the poor guy who whose mail sounds wouldn't work. And I was really surprised to hear Dave suggest to reinstall the whole operating system just so the guy could get his mail sounds back. Oh, Dave, finger wag.
Hey, well, that, you know, just to be fair, that wasn't my first suggestion. It was sort of my last resort suggestion. But you're right. I didn't think of what you're about to suggest, Ken.
What I would try first is maybe restoring the whole OS from Time Machine. I don't know if that's what you were suggesting by a reinstall. But obviously, Time Machine lets you go back to previous versions, assuming 10.6 and 10.6.1. He did have these mail sounds. The other thing to try would be to, using his Mac OS X install DVD, to maybe restore mail.app. I think that install DVD has those default Mac apps on there, like iChat and Safari and all that kind of stuff, in case you really muck those up someday.
I just to be fair, I don't think it has those apps. So if you're hunting for them and you can't find them, that's why. But here comes the money part here from Ken.
You can restore them that way. The other thing you could try would be to go to Show Package Contents on mail.app and go into Contents Resources and then sort by kind. And the mail sounds are those four AIFF files in there. And one thing he can do is try to either drag or copy those out of that folder and into his library sounds folder, and then go into the mail preferences and select those sound files once they are in there. He might want to try that. Anyway, love the show. Say hi to Pilot Pete for me. Bye.
Hi, Pilot Pete.
Hey, guys. That's a nice couple comments in me. I feel wanted and loved.
This I know, awesome. Man. We had a lot of people asking about you the last couple of weeks. Yeah. So, Ken, thank you. That's the magic answer right there, is go in and, you know, even if you have to go to another machine, right? Like, if I was having this problem, I could call John up and say, hey, man, right-click on Mail App, even though you don't use Mail, right-click on Mail App, go to Show Package Contents, go into Contents Resources, and then in there, you will find those .AIFF files, as Ken pointed out. Copy those out. I could then, you know, he could email them to me, I could copy them back, and there you go. You know, software licenses be damned. I don't know. You know, it is what it is. You know, we both own copies of Snow Leopard. Let's you know, be real. Okay. So thank you, Ken. And thank you for, you know, keeping us honest here. Like, we very much appreciate that. Because you're right. Nuke and Pave is not the, it is the end, the last result. But in this case, we have a much more finely tuned.
It's throwing in the towel.
It is throwing in the towel. Absolutely. All right. We had, you know, as often happens, we will get questions in clumps, and we have two that are very much related here. The first one is from Michael, both via email, and he says, I have a regular text document placed on the dock. By default, it opens in TextEdit. However, I would like this file and this file only to open in Mac VIM. The reason being that I have a specific syntax format set up for this file in Mac VIM. Is there a way to achieve this? And yes. So the answer
is hope.
Yeah, there is hope. So go ahead, John. You take it. Go ahead.
I could say that on any file, if you right click or control click, I believe, unless you have a multi-button device, which I'm not being going to get started about Apple pointy devices. We will save a rant session for that.
I think I've got a magic mouse coming, by the way. But
are you serious?
Yeah.
Really?
Keep going. Yeah.
What's wrong with you? Anyways, right click, control click, get info.
From the file menu. Yep.
Open with. Well, no, in the contextual menu.
Yeah, you could also do it from the file menu. You could just highlight and go to file. Correct. And get info. All three will get you to the same place. And John, that is?
And then in the window will be open with. And you will see a list of applications. There will be a default application for that file type, which how macOS 10 determines that, Dave, I think, is a deep and arcane and mysterious subject.
And it's getting less arcane with Snow Leopard, but I don't want to go there right.
Excellent.
Now.
Okay. Yeah. But we will. You know what I'm talking about.
I do.
So
yeah.
As many of our geeky listeners, and not so geeky, but you want to be geeky, and here's how you become geek. Now, there are many ways a file can identify what made it and who should deal with it when you ask the operating system, deal with this. It could be something lame like an extension, like a dot something, or it could be something buried in the file like Apple has done for a while. But anyways.
John?
Anyways. Yes.
Are you still with us?
Yes, I think so.
Okay, good. Yes.
Where are we?
Welcome. We're here. Back, so man. You're changing. So you've got the get info window open.
I'm sorry. Get info. Okay. Open with. And then you will see a list of applications. We will not care right now what lists them there. But you can either open with what is listed there by default or in the list. And I think you can also, for the most part, there's a little button that should be lit up saying change all, which means, all right, this. Excuse me. This document, just set this one to open with the default application. Change all, that's a more drastic move, which I think we'll cover in a few moments. So that is a long, quick.
That's right.
Summary of what you're going
to
do there.
So the trick here, just to crystallize this for you, is for you, Michael, you only want this file to change. You don't want all your text files to change. You want everything else to open in TextEdit. You want this to open in Mac VIM. So for you,
Vim. What is Vim?
Vim is an old. It's a Mac port of an old Unix text editor, I believe.
VIM. Okay, like Emacs or VI or something.
Exactly.
Oh.
It's based on VI. Yeah.
Got it. Okay.
So for you, you want to choose Mac VIM from the open with dropdown, but do not click the change all button. You only want to change it for this file. So that's that. And then just to complete the circle, Aaron writes in and says, on my Power Mac G5, and I don't I don't believe what I'm about to read, but we'll take it. And the context is fine. It says, on my Power Mac G5, I've got Parallels running. And now in my Finder, it wants to open some files up in Parallels. How do I tell it to open with my Mac and not Windows? I know you can change it by going in and right clicking on them one by one, but doing this on so many files would take a long time to do them one by one. Okay. For him, he would choose one of the files, and there might be a couple of different file types that this is happening with. So you might have to do this three or four times. But with each file that you find that's opening in Parallels and you don't want it to, go ahead and choose whatever Mac program you want to have open it. And then, of course, click change all. And that will change all of the files of that same type. But if there's another type where this is happening, you might have to do it again. It's very common for this to happen for like Adobe people with Adobe Acrobat installed. And you decide, no, I don't want Acrobat Reader to open for my PDFs. I want Preview to open my PDFs. And so, you know, off you go.
And
so,
we're not going to talk about the difference between a file suffix or a file type or creator or anything like that, right?
Well, I'd rather do some research on that. It changed dramatically in Snow Leopard.
Did it?
Okay. Yeah.
Because I know it was always convoluted where sometimes, and even when I migrated my MacBook Pro, some files got a bit confused as to who owned them. And I'm like, no, I really didn't associate you with a Preview or something like that. One of the default apps I associated with you with Acrobat, and now you're lost. What happened?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
We'll dig.
I think
that's good.
I think there's an article on Ars Technica that we will link to in the show notes, and then we can talk some more about it. But
I've been confused. It's not a showstopper, but it's annoying.
It's different. John Syracuse took care to dig in, and as they do over there at Ars, and explain this stuff. So we'll go through it at some point. I have a cursory understanding of what has changed, but I don't want to go into it here without.
Is it a mess? Deeper.
It's not as much of a mess as you think it is when you start digging into it. Yeah. So it's one of those things. So
excellent.
Anyway, our second sponsor for this show is Circus Ponies, and Circus Ponies creates an app called Notebook, and they're up to version 3.0. Notebook is a place to organize your various bits and pieces of data and information about common projects. So let's say you want to organize all your recipes, and you also want to have a place to organize your notes for, let's say, a family reunion, or maybe you've got Thanksgiving coming up and you're organizing your recipes and who you're bringing. You can create a notebook for any topic you want. And then inside that, you can just start typing. Or you can drag images in, or you can drag PDFs in, and you can annotate the things that you bring in there. And if you get a fax from somebody, you can scan that fax in and OCR it, and which means you can take the text that's on the fax and turn it into editable text. All of this happens inside Notebook, and then you can search. So let's say you've got Thanksgiving planned, and you know when you're going to get the turkey and who's going to bring the cranberry relish and who's doing this and who's doing that. And then you think, oh gosh, you know, what's the stuffing? What's the deal with the stuffing? Well, you search for stuffing, and bam, you find stuffing inside the notebook, and you can see, okay, yep, here's the recipe. I've got stuffing here. I've got, you know, it's going to take me 20 minutes to make, and here's the PDF of the recipe all contained inside Notebook. Now, of course, you don't have to just do this for Thanksgiving. You could do it for projects you have at work, or if you're a student, projects at school, or really anything you want. They do start you out with some templates to kind of give you an idea as to what's possible in the program, because it is sort of daunting to start with a blank slate. So they take care of that for you. And the other thing they take care of is you don't have to buy it if you want to try it. You can go to circusponies.com, download a free trial, check it out. And then when you are ready to buy, go back, and it's $49.95 for a standard license. If you're a student, you get a break, $20 off. It's $29.95. And if you want to have a 3-user license in your home, That's $99.95 for what they call a family pack license. All of this at circusponies.com. This is Notebook version 3.0. All right. How are we doing on time here, John? Oh, okay. We're doing all right. We can get into some of the questions. We sort of set up the show backwards today and put the questions at the end. And I like that because it keeps us honest. And of course, I have to keep going through and editing my notes, but that's okay.
Greg?
Yeah, let's go to Greg. Let me find Greg out here. There he is. Okay. So Greg says, I have two questions. My first question somewhat relates to sleeping questions that have been asked recently. I have an early 2008 iMac and one of the most recent MacBook Pros, the 13-inch. Sometimes when I'm at home using the iMac, I want to access some files on the MacBook Pro through our Airport Extreme wireless network. I have both computers set to wake on network access, and the MacBook Pro is one that supports doing this wirelessly, which is cool, so that one will wake if I'm trying to access the other. I've noticed that when the lid on the MacBook Pro is open, I'm able to successfully wake the computer remotely and access files as normal. However, if the lid is closed, the connection will time out and I can't access the computer at all. Do you know if this is by design or is there some problem that may be fixed? I would like to work with the lid closed if possible to increase the life of the LCD and backlight, even if it's minimal. In both situations, the MacBook Pro is plugged in. And that's right. The MacBook Pro can be woken up wirelessly, but it has to be plugged into power to do so, if I'm not mistaken. And this is only true of the newest crop of MacBook Pros. The rest can be woken wired, but not wirelessly. But yeah, so the reason is, and the older MacBook Pros are like this too, if you're trying to wake them remotely, they will not wake up with the lid closed if there is no other monitor plugged in. And that's because the theory is, why would you want to wake up a computer if you can't see what you're doing? So without a keyboard or a monitor plugged in, I don't believe it will wake up. And that is expected behavior and by design. And here's the other thing. I know these computers, you know, there's a whole, knowledge base section about running these computers in lid closed mode. I've done this. It gets hot, man. I get worried. Now, I know I shouldn't be worried. In fact, I was talking to someone who creates kind of a dock for the MacBook Pro so that you can plug it into a monitor. And they said they've done tests for like the last year on it. And you shouldn't be worried about heat. But I worry about heat. It's just kind of how I roll. So what do you think, John?
Well, I got to say, for example, on my current MacBook, the bar between above the function keys, I don't know if you've noticed, that gets very, very, very warm.
Well, that's where the processor
machine
are.
Apart.
Yeah,
that's where the heat sinks and the heat bars and whatever you want to call the heat dissipation in that machine.
The fans.
That's where it is.
Yeah,
and it's near the fans, but it's also this metal bar that is between the screen and the keyboard, because you're probably not going to touch that, but if you do, you will notice it is extremely hot.
Yeah, and I'd worry about cooking the screen with that.
And I'm with you.
Yeah.
In having the lid closed, even though the fans are functioning and that blows out the back of the machine,
yep,
having that heat source pressed against your screen, makes me a bit uneasy.
Yeah.
So I'd be hesitant to run any portable machine with the lid down.
Just to be fair, it is, Apple will warranty your machine. If your machine cooks and it's like that and you're under warranty and you tell them, I cooked it because I ran it closed, they'd say, oh, well, that shouldn't happen. Here's a new machine. Or they'd fix, whatever they needed to fix it. So
I'm with you. I have never done it and I don't think I'd be comfortable. So that's just, hey, that's how I roll.
But by design, you can't run it lid closed without a screen attached. So so that is question number one. This is my second question, Greg says, also deals with my MacBook Pro. When I purchased the computer, the Apple saleswoman told me that I should always try to let the battery run down as much as possible before charging it. She said that if any work needed to be done in the future, a Mac Genius may look at the cycle count in the system profiler to see if any excessive charging had occurred. I know that Apple has specified the battery to last about 1,000 cycles. My questions are as follows. What constitute a cycle of the battery? And two, is there some percentage that I should allow my battery to get down to before charging? Are there any other best practices that I and or the rest of the Mac Geek Gab community should be aware of? of which we should be aware, right? And we're going to turn that around, make my English teachers happy. All right. Forget the English teachers now. Let's just answer the question.
I got to laugh at the statement, excessive charging. Come on.
I don't even know what that means. That's like that old Saturday Night Live skit, right? You know, you can never put too much water on a nuclear reactor, you know, and then the guy left for vacation, right?
What are you talking about?
and nobody knew what to do. So, yeah, anyway.
All right, I'm going to give my off-the-cuff opinion here, but the charge cycles is when you reach the maximum capacity of the battery, it sets the charge cycles to one.
But not if it hasn't gone all the way down.
So are you implying, and I don't know this, let us know, folks.
Yeah.
That it has to go all the way to zero because
I think it's got to get below either 10 or 5% and then charge all the way.
Oh, the red zone.
It's got to get into the red zone.
We say the red zone is where if you use the battery icon in your menu bar, which you may not, and if you don't, you should. You really
Wow. We got to levy the guilt upon you, man.
Thou shalt use the battery icon.
But it will turn red when, as they pointed out, you're below a certain threshold, whether it be capacity or time,
right,
saying your battery's in bad shape. And then eventually you'll get the alert saying, I'm sorry, man, I'm really going to shut down, so you better, you know, do something about this quick.
Right.
I would really like to, we should research this. I'm convinced when it gets to full charge, that is a charge cycle, but I'm wondering if what you're saying.
It's not a full cycle because I've had batteries for like a year and a half and it's had, you know, 20 something cycles on it because I haven't been good and I haven't let it charge down. And it does get to, you know, 98% and then back up. So no, a full cycle. It's got to get down at least into the red zone, right, and then you're right, go back all the way to 100.
So what I'll say is my MacBook Pro here, same one as you have, Dave.
Yep.
I currently show 220 charge cycles, and it lists that as 55% of battery life remaining for charge cycles. So
interesting.
This battery has about 400 whatever charge cycles.
Yeah.
I'm using Battery Health Monitor, which is one tool to show you these figures because it will tell you within the capability of this program, and it lists capacity in milliamp hours, charge in milliamp hours, and also charge cycles that it's been through. And it appears that there's a threshold where if you reach that, like in this case, it shows, you know, after 200 more charges, my charge cycles will be shot.
But is that Apple's number or is that this app's number?
This is this app reporting what the battery says to it. So it's like, dude, I've done this.
Yeah, okay.
That's my understanding.
Because my battery
is the battery.
My battery's at 69 cycles.
Yep.
So.
Okay.
Yep. Yeah. Whatever that means. But I know it's been to, you know, 95 and back up many more times than that in the, you know, in the whatever it is, 2 years that we've had it.
Yeah, and it's weird, actually, because only with Snow Leopard in the battery menu, we love the battery menu. And I'm going to talk about it a little more, but on occasion, I have seen in the battery menu, it has a little, you know, one of those caution signs, Dave.
Yeah.
And it says battery. I wish I had a screenshot, but it says, like, you know, battery malfunction or not malfunction, but
no, I've got it. Mine says
you've
it.
You've seen that
fact.
Too.
No,
in Snow Leopard. It says battery warning. And when you go to it, it brings up a help page saying you may want to go to your Apple store and talk to them because it seems your battery is messed up.
Yeah, I actually have to do that because my battery on my MacBook Pro, I used screen sharing to go look at it just now, and it actually says service battery right there in the menu.
Service battery, that's it. You got that too. But the thing is, I've seen it come and go, and I'm nervous.
It doesn't come and go on mine. And really where it comes from...
Okay, then your battery's shot.
Yeah, well, here's the thing. If you look in System Profiler, and you go into the power setting, you see a bunch of information at the top under the battery information category. And on mine... And I'm curious to hear what yours says, John. On mine, it says my full charge capacity is 3,384 milliamp hours. Now, this was over 5,000 milliamp hours when I got the machine. So my full battery capacity is much lower than it should be.
Mm-hmm.
Right? What's yours at? System
original
profiler
on my MacBook Pro.
Yeah, go into system profiler.
Well, I'm here on. All right, we'll do system profiler.
Yep. And then click on power under the hardware tab section. And then you'll see battery information, and it'll tell you what your full charge capacity is.
Fully charged. Full charge capacity, 4337.
Yeah. And
draining, 4312.
Yep.
Fully charged, no. Charging, yes.
Yeah. So your battery's capacity is 30% more than mine, and I think yours is probably about 1,000 milliamp hours down from where it was when you got it. I remember mine being at like 51 when I got my machine. So the capacity of the battery, as happens with all batteries, dies over time.
Because I have two.
And the best thing you can do.
I swap them based on charge cycles. So okay. I look at that, and whenever they get close, I flip them.
Hmm. Interesting. Yeah, so the best thing you can do, and John, you're taking better care of your batteries than I am, because you are cycling them more frequently than I cycle mine. And that is what, you know, you don't want to do it three times a day if you don't have to, but certainly at least once a month, and probably based on what I'm seeing with mine, more than that. Maybe once a week is a good, you know, a good thing to do. Is that about what you say you do, John? Would you say you cycle through, you know, all the way down to zero at least once a week?
Yeah, I'm with you. Yeah, sometimes overnight, and then I'll leave it overnight to charge during the day.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Okay, good. All right.
Where are we?
We are on to Alex. And Alex has an interesting question. I think we have an interesting answer.
Hi, John and Dave, and maybe Pilot Pete. This is Alex in Berkeley. Love the show, as always. As a convert from Windows, one thing that pops up now and again as a minor annoyance is something I used to be able to do in the other OS that I can't seem to do on my Mac, and that is renaming in the Save dialog. Occasionally, when I'm saving a file, I'll realize that another file in the target directory has the wrong name, or perhaps I want to rename it by appending old or something so I can use that file's name for the newer file that I'm saving rather than just overwriting it. But there doesn't seem to be a way to do any manipulation in the save dialog box itself. So I would have to consequently keep the save dialog box open and then go to Finder and do the rename and then go back to the save dialog box and save the file. I've poked around and haven't found any answers. Also, while I'm saving my shekels for Pathfinder, which looks great, by the way, and I'm happy they're a sponsor of the show, I don't think it works inside the save dialog box, so I assume that's not going to solve this issue. I'm running Leopard on a prior model MacBook. So, guys, is there a solution for what I'm looking for here, or is it in Snow Leopard? Thanks, and you can cut me off here.
So when I heard this question, John, I thought, well, of course he can rename in the save dialog, and I popped up a save dialog, and I right clicked on a file name that I saw, you know, in the list there, and there's an option to rename, and I thought, well, yeah, he must be missing something, and then it hit me, like, oh, wait a minute, let me try this on another machine, and so I screen shared into another machine, and I tried it, and it wasn't there. And I'm guessing you'll probably try it, Pete, and it's not there.
Nope.
Okay, good. And what I realized was I have been using default folder on my main Mac for so long that I have become completely reliant on it. And this is one of those things. So default folder, if you've never used it, is a program that enhances open and save dialogs in many ways. It adds a bunch of different options over to the kind of hanging off the right of an open and save dialog where you can pull up recent folders. You can pull up all the folders that are open in the Finder. So if you had a folder open in the Finder, but your open and save dialog isn't there, you can immediately map it there. If you have a folder open in the Finder, instead of navigating to it, you can click on it in the Finder and it'll bring your open and save dialog there. And
that to me is one of the most compelling features of this.
It's
is that what you see on the desktop is linked to what the dialog you're trying to wrangle with is asking you for. It's like, where do you want to go? Oh, well, I'm going to trudge through the usual, you know, bogus, you know, folder, whatever dialogue. I'm sorry. It's just not a quick way to do it. How about what I see? So to me, that's always been one of the most compelling features about default folder to me.
Now, it's not free. I forget how much it is. I think it's like $30. Yeah, it's from St. Clair Software, which is stclairsoft.com. And of course, there'll be a link in the show notes. But I don't know it. And I'm sure there's a free trial of it because it's software and that's how you do it when you're a Mac software developer. But I don't know if there's anything freely available that perhaps is less full featured than default folder or not. I've been using it since Mac OS 9. So I honestly have not looked for anything else. I just keep paying my money every time they ask me for it. And I'm happy.
Okay. But what came to me is that he said the save dialog. Now to me, there's the save dialog and the save as dialog.
But if you listen to his comment, John, he was looking to rename other files in that list.
Okay.
He said, you know, when I'm going in and I notice there's another file that I want to change the name of, or I want to save it as the same name of a file that's in there, but rename the existing one to old so I don't have to overwrite. Right.
Yep.
So he's looking to manipulate things from within the dialog and default folder will do it either in save or in open dialogs. It doesn't matter. All right. So yeah, if anybody out there knows of anything that's freely available, please let us know. Cause I'd always like to share that sort of stuff too. But default, they're not a sponsor of the show. But default folder is an app I couldn't possibly live without. So, I highly recommend it if that's what you're looking for. All right. We've got a lot of stuff and there's nothing quick here. I'm going to bring in the band, John. I think so. Yeah, I think so. Cause otherwise we're going to go and go and go and go. I'm trying to look at our thing here. Yeah, there's just, you know what? Let's do Chris. I like this. This is interesting.
Hey, John and Dave. This is Chris. I was recently at the Apple Store, and I'd have problems with my keyboard. The ZXCVBNM, comma, and period keys and the left-hand command key were all not working. Apple said it must have been a bad keyboard and said it was going to be about $200 to replace. So I went online, being out of warranty, and bought a new keyboard and replaced it myself and took it back into the Apple Store, because after the repair it was doing the same exact thing, which led me to think that it was either software or the logic board, and they had told me that it was damaged because I had improperly reinstalled the new keyboard and that they wouldn't even fix it. So I was wondering, is it possible this could be software problems, or is it most definitely just a logic board problem? But I didn't know if maybe there was a relationship between that bottom row of keys or not. Any help would be much appreciated. This is where you cut me off. Hey, John.
Oops, I started him again.
Okay, dude, it's absolutely a hardware problem.
Unless it's software.
There was no...
I couldn't help.
There was no way you could have that collection of keys all malfunction without it being a hardware problem. And the reason I say this is as follows. At least when I looked at keyboards and the way keyboards work, to me it almost indicates to me that a row or column strobe that talks to the keyboard saying, hey, anybody pressing a key, is damaged. And just that whole group is damaged to me seems too weird for software to figure out how to even make it do that. So...
Yeah, I'm with you. The only way that would be, not the only way, the most probable way that it would be software is if it were a virus, right? I mean, if somebody were just trying to mess with you.
It's just too weird.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
again, because they're all together. Now, if they were scattered about, I'd say it's, you know, based on something like I did recently, which is the whole liquid based attack.
Right. But, you know, he replaced.
They're all in the same place. I got to almost say it's an electrical.
That's electrical, John.
Talk much, John.
Sorry, thinking too fast. Yeah, but it's a problem with the context on that, you know, row in the keyboard.
Except that he's replaced the keyboard. And he has the same problem.
The connector then, I'm sorry.
Yeah, and I think that's right. I did find an old discussion about PowerBook keyboards, you know, on the Apple discussion site there. And they talked about it being a bad connector. And what these people were doing, what they found was if they took the machine apart and really kind of applied some pressure to the connector and then put it all back together, it would work for a little while. And then it would come jarred loose and they'd have, you know, a very similar problem. Yeah. On the PowerBooks, and again, now this gets into the layout of the machine, but a bunch of people found that taking one of the RAM chips out, if they had a very thick RAM chip in the second slot, that was causing this to, you know, maybe warp a little bit inside the computer and pop this connector out and cause this problem.
Close.
So, yeah.
So to clarify, what I worked on before is that when I replaced my keyboard, there was a connector slash clamp, pressure clamp, I'll call it, where you had to put the keyboard power lead into another part of the machine, and it was not only a connector, but it had a little thing that kind of hinged, and you had to press it down to apply pressure so the ribbon cable would be connected to the circuit board.
Right.
And because of that, and it didn't look very stable. I mean, it seemed very fragile. So that's why I'm wondering if one of those, or in another part of the machine, if you don't have one of those cables making a good connection, like if it's just a little bit loose, then you're going to lose a row or column of keys, which, it just sounds too weird. So there's some issues, I think. If you put the keyboard back together and you don't get it quite right, which I can certainly empathize with.
But, my guess is if reseating that keyboard connector doesn't work for you, Chris, it is the logic board. And that gets to be a very expensive repair. You know, if Apple won't touch it now because you've admitted to opening it, well, you could go somewhere else, right? Go to a different Apple store. They probably don't have it logged. Alternatively, right? Why not?
Are we saying don't get caught?
Yeah, we're saying, or if you got caught, go somewhere else where they aren't going to catch you.
We haven't caught you yet.
That's right.
Well, I believe that there are a class of people, Apple authorized service providers.
Yeah, and they'll be
not Apple stores.
No, they do operate under a license from Apple, so they
know what they're doing.
But
you hope.
No, they definitely. My experience with them has been great. Pete had a strange issue with one locally that we don't really.
Had a cracked screen, but on the machine when I got it back. But Apple customer service stepped
totally
up to the plate and fixed it. Yeah,
that's
$400
true.
Repair job.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah.
All right.
But Apple authorized repair. Or if you don't want to go to a service center, you could send it off to a tech restore or Mac Fix It or not Mac Fix It. That's the website. Mac Rescue. Sorry. All right. I do want to do Charlie's comment here, and we do have time for it, John. Okay. So Charlie has two quick questions. Number one, I have iTunes University content, audio and video, in my iTunes library from several years ago. I see that iTunes 9 now has an area in the client for iTunes U. How do I move my iTunes University content, currently under podcasts and movies, into the correct iTunes U area in the new client? I tried moving it manually and nothing happened. If you don't have any iTunes U content, you probably don't have this feature turned on. But if you do have it, it appears in iTunes 9 just like as another heading, like music, movies, podcasts, TV shows. There's just an iTunes U comment or section in there. And once you have it enabled, then we can jump back to Paul's tip from the beginning of the show, where you highlight the content, you choose Get Info, and you can highlight multiple shows at once if you want. Choose Get Info from the, I believe, file menu. Go to the Options tab. Go to Media Kind. And that's where you can choose. Paul was talking about setting things to be a podcast, but iTunes U does show up in that list if iTunes U content is enabled in your iTunes. So and that will bounce the stuff over there for you, Chris. Sorry, Charlie. I'm getting everybody's names confused. Number two, unless you have something on that, John.
None.
Good. What a program in your experience or the listener's experience is the best speech to text program for the Mac? Repetitive stress issues in my wrists and forearms are forcing me to seriously consider looking at this application area. For me, the only one I've ever used on the Mac is Mac Speech. I haven't used it a whole lot, but it's worked very, very well. And I've heard lots of people talk and say good things about it. Happy to have comments from the listeners about either Mac Speech or other products. But that's the one I would steer you towards. I said, I don't use it every day, so I have hard pressed to say recommend, but I don't think I haven't heard of anything better out there for the Mac.
So. The people that I talk to on Twitter and other venues that use this sort of thing, that seems to be the best solution. I would just say, don't get your hopes up. It's not Hal, and actually probably shouldn't be Hal.
Yeah, that would be a bad
thing.
Because
Hal wants to kill you. But still, from what I've seen, I've done speech recognition research for a number of years. A system that you can train, even minimally, is the one that's going to, and with an idea of what you're going to say. Like if you're going to say numbers or whatever, if it knows roughly what you're going to say and you've trained it to your voice, you're going to get as good as you're going to get with today's technology. Again, we're not going to get to Hal. We're not getting to, you know, biocomputers and stuff. And they basically are doing pattern matching. And the problem is people don't always talk the same.
Right.
So, you know, they do the best they can. They average out the results. But, again, if you're doing numbers or repetitive tasks or predictable tasks and you can pick your vocabulary, they can work very, very well. And I've seen that almost 100%.
Yeah. I've heard good things about Mac Speech. So that's definitely the first one I'd check out. But if anybody else has any comments on that, actually, I'd love to kind of go into a little bit of that here on the show. So we look to you and we appreciate it.
But Dave, if you want to look to us, oh my gosh, we didn't even mention this, did we?
No, but we will now. Because, how to contact us?
And you know, Dave, the first thing I think when I want to contact the Mac Geek app, I want to pick up the phone or my iPod. Or whatever. But no, if I pick up the phone, I want to dial 206-666-GEEK, which is
4335. Or you can create an email to feedback@macgeekgab.com.
Dave, I thought I heard you say feedback@macgeekgab.com, but I just want to make sure that's exactly what you said.
Oh, you heard me right. That's feedback@macgeekgab.com. You can type text in the email. You can put pictures in the email. You can put an audio comment in the email. You can put all three because we are multimedia operation here, folks. This is first class. That's right. So you can even record that audio with your iPhone using the Voice Memo app. And I think quite a few of the comments in the show tonight came in that way. But, you know, you can even record them with the microphone on your Mac. It's going to sound better. What's this? What's going on?
Just cracking me up.
Okay.
Multimedia. That's just such an arcane term.
Oh, that's right. We're a full service operation here, man. And I'm willing to go back 10 years and use a watchword that's no longer popular. You know, I'm that kind of guy. You can see the show notes at MacGeekGab.com. You can follow us on Twitter, and a lot of you do, and interact with us there, and it's a great place to a great venue for that. You can follow John on Twitter. He is twitter.com/JohnFBraun. I am twitter.com/DaveHamilton. Pete is twitter.com/PilotPete. Yo. And you can follow the show comments as a whole at twitter.com/MacGeekGab and also twitter.com/MacObserver. So I think that'll keep you busy on Twitter. So you can Skype us to MacGeekGab. And I think did I cover it all, John?
You got it, brother.
All right. I am not presenting, but I'm going to be in. It just so happens that I'm going to be in Austin on December 8th, which is the date of their December CapMac meeting. I believe Bob Levitis is the presenter that night.
Dr. Bob.
But I will be there in attendance, and it's a they're a great bunch of folks there. I know quite a few of them personally, and I will be there. So if you're going to be in town, come on out. And if you're there, say hi. I always like to, nice. To meet
we
folks.
We did a session with them, I think.
In Austin? I don't
know. Oh, maybe not. Maybe another group.
Yeah. iPhone Alley, as I mentioned before, is Michael Johnston's site. He converts this show to AAC for you. Cachefly.com, CacheFly.com, provides all the bandwidth to get this show from us to you. The podcast marketplace includes the A2 desktop speakers from Audio Engine, Disc Label from Smile on My Mac, Yojimbo from Barebone Software, Pathfinder 5 from Cocotec, and Notebook from Circus Ponies, all through the Backbeat Media podcast network. John, you got anything, any parting words of wisdom here?
Good night. set your clock. Oh, what are you supposed to do?
Oh, yeah, that's right. You know, we had so much fun.
It's daylight savings time.
No,
Dave.
No, saving time.
I know.
It's over, though. It's we don't have that anymore. And it's not plural. And we had so much fun setting them back an hour and getting that extra hour of sleep. This weekend, we're doing it again.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Awesome.
Whatever you do, though, don't get caught.
Made up.